The Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by HippoCamp 2018. Now in its fourth year, HippoCamp is a three-day creative nonfiction writing conference that features 50-plus speakers, engaging sessions in four tracks, interactive all-conference panels, author and attendee readings, social activities, networking opportunities, and optional intimate pre-conference workshops. The conference takes place in lovely Lancaster, Pennsylvania, from August 24th through August 26th. Visit hippocampusmagazine.com and click the conference tab in the toolbar. And if you enter the keyword CNFPOD at checkout, you will receive a $50 discount. This offer is only good until August 10th or until all those tickets are sold. And they are selling. There are a limited number, so act now. HippoCamp 2018. Create, share, live. Ever catch yourself staring at the sky at night and being categorically floored? Hair blown back by the scope of it all? This happens to me almost nightly, and there's two distinct approaches you can take, and I've taken both of them, believe you me. I look up and realize the lottery. We all, as animals, have won by being born in this little blue dot, the perfect distance away from the nearest star, and also how lucky we are that we aren't collectively born into one of the planet's ice ages. Thinking like this makes fear seem so trivial. Like, why not write that book, or the essay, or make that movie, or start a podcast, or hang up whatever shingle you like? You already won. Go cash your ticket. Go to the 7-Eleven. Go cash it, and he'll just say, congratulations, and you'll be on the news. The other approach is, we are so insignificant, so alone, so tiny, that quite literally, none of this matters. It will all end up burned or underwater, and when the sun reaches full maturity, when we're all long gone, our little blue dot probably won't be so blue anymore. Maybe not even a dot, but dust, wiped from the cosmic hard drive. So why do anything at all? I prefer approach one, frankly, but sometimes it's hard not to be hijacked by approach two. Which brings me to my guest today, the brilliant filmmaker Emer Reynolds, whose documentary, The Farthest, chronicles the incredible story behind the Voyager mission and the desire to seek out the unknowable while also seeking to be known. The golden record, Carl Sagan, the personification of this little spacecraft, carrying with it everything that makes us human.
Just look, it's all brain food. It's all creative food.
Hey, this is my show where I talk to the best creators about the art and craft of telling true stories, so you can apply those tools of the trade to get better at your own work. I'm Brendan O'Mara. And this is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. My guest today is based in Ireland and talks about the craft of making documentary film, her obsessiveness with research, and how exciting and empowering making a film is. If you love film and true stories, as well as the vast reaches of outer space, then you're going to love this one. If you don't already subscribe to the podcast, please head over to Apple Podcasts and do so, or wherever else you do it, but let's face it, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, that's where you do it. And consider leaving a rating or a review. Ratings take like 5 seconds, review a little longer, but you know, good on you if you can do either one. Helps with the show's visibility. Also, head over to BrendanO'Mara.com for show notes and to subscribe to my monthly reading list newsletter. It's a fine piece of thing, where I send out my book picks and other goodies from the podcast. Please share this episode across your platforms if you dig it, and I don't think you won't dig it. Double negatives. Hashtag double negative. Why wait any longer? Here's Emer Reynolds. Tell true stories through a visual medium versus, say, well, which a lot of people, they tend to approach it through a writing medium.
Well, I came to it pretty circuitous route, in fairness. I have been an editor, a feature film editor, for a long time, over 20 years, and in that time I've edited an awful lot of feature drama, but I also edited a lot of feature documentaries. So in that period of my life, you know, in all those years, I was really enthralled and kind of lit up by editing documentary, and you know how you know, there's nothing more extraordinary than real life. And, you know, had the opportunity to work on some beautiful and powerful and wonderful films with some great directors. And weirdly, even though I had, you know, taken to doing a bit of directing of drama, it had never, strange to say, it had never really occurred to me to direct documentary. You know, I hadn't really asked myself that question. So my first documentary to direct, I was on as a co-director. It was called Here Was Cube. I co-directed with John Murray, and he just actually asked me, because we had worked as director and editor on a number of films, very, very happily, very happy collaboration. And he asked me, would I consider co-directing Here Was Cuba, which is about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And you know, a little bit of bolt from the blue, I was like, oh yeah, I guess. That sounds really interesting, you know. And when I look back now, I can't even imagine that it didn't occur to me as being, you know, a job for me, but it hadn't. And he gave me that opportunity, and, you know, a bit of duck to water and all that. I from the day and hour I started, I was just like, oh my God, why wasn't I doing this all the time? You know, it's really, really suits my personality, and it really suits what I'm interested in, you know, finding out about material, digging in, doing all the lovely research, meeting these amazing people, and dreaming up a kind of a way to tell a story, you know. And it's so stimulating, it's so intriguing, you know, I loved it. So, you know, I couldn't wait. Once we made Here Was Cuba, I couldn't wait to keep making more.
Yeah, was it something of a challenge for you to have the boundaries of verifiable fact as a way for as your ore to then sort of mine that stuff to tell a true story? Like, you like that challenge of having those boundaries?
You know, I certainly didn't see it as any sort of limitation in a negative way. You know, it seemed like a very healthy boundary that. Facts matter, and to tell the story, you know, as well and as expansively and as creatively and as imaginatively as you can, while wandering with it between these kind of poles of, yeah, as you say, verifiable facts. And I really enjoyed the kind of the rigor of it. In fact, really enjoyed, you know, feeling that it was important to get it right, important to verify. Let's say for something like the Here Was Cuba, you know, you have competing versions of events, you know, and to feel that one would be truthful in as far as one could, and respectful of the interviewees and the research, and also take a view of your own, you know. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed those. I enjoyed that rigor.
And you said that the process and the craft of documentary filmmaking and that form of storytelling really resonated with your personality. And I wonder, in what way did that really resonate with your personality?
For better, for worse, and in fact, a lot of the time for worse, because I can't really sleep, because I have a, you know, a kind of a, my sister calls it a monkey mind, you know, and my brain is kind of jumping around, needs a lot of stimulation, needs a lot of brain food, you know, and it's a kind of a burden, because, you know, it's not really social media or reading newspapers into the night. It's just my mind, you know, jumping around looking for things to explore and consider and learn about. So it really, really suits that part of me, you know, that I can really dig in and swim around in a subject and, you know, really learn deeply. You become an expert, you know, for a few years about something, and then, you know, a year later, you know, you've forgotten some basic information about it. So it's kind of strange, but it definitely suits my voracious appetite for intellectual stimulation. And on a personal side, or as a character, interested in people, like meeting new people, like hearing deep stories, like engaging with people at that level about their work, about their motivation. So on both films, really, really, really loving getting to meet the people central to these stories and draw them out, and get to know them and draw out their stories in a very, human and honest way. So I think in those two ways in particular, I really enjoy the form. I also enjoy, there's a freshness to it if you are given the opportunity to paint in a new way, paint in dream up a visual palette or, a style that might be new to the subject or might be a fresh way of looking at a subject, and that's really, really, really exciting and really aesthetically and creatively very pleasing.
And as a teenager or a young adult, were you always very, if something interested you, were you always very obsessive about it and would go down the rabbit hole until it could not go any deeper?
I think so, yeah. I might have to refer you to my sisters for that, but my father was, a great intellectual, had been cut short in his desire to explore his intellectual potential because he had his own father had died when he was young, so he'd had to kind of leave school early and become and go working to support his mother and family. So, but he was an amazing, sparky and impressive and inspirational kind of person, and it was everything in our house from. There's a whole wall full of Reader's Digest books. He was really, really interested in writing and in literature and in facts to do with the First World War, the Second, like real voracious reader to do with all of that. Mad about spelling and grammar and but also mad about science and maths. And we used to do maths and physics puzzles just for fun, So I kind of grew up in a world where, if that was your bag, if that was your thing, that the height of it would be to just jump in and swim around and explore everything. So, we had a really, really, it was a very fertile kind of way to grow up and have your mind just provoked and kind of prodded. And I think I was like that from young, although, like, for example, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, I wasn't a big history nerd. I was much more of a science nerd, so. It's interesting now to see myself finding, new subjects and new spheres that I might not be very well learned about, but I'm really excited and lit up about learning about them.
As a self-prescribed science nerd, what about that? What particular subjects really stuck in your stuck in your brain from a young age that kind of of course will lead to a very deep scientific exploration in your later work?
I have actually tried to explore this in my mind the last year because I've been talking a bit about it, but I can't really recall where the obsession came from. I was certainly very good at maths and physics in school and went on to study maths and physics in Trinity in Dublin. But, really, really interested in space in particular from a very, very young age and led on to being like really, really interested in science fiction as an art form and wanted to be an astronaut. I don't know why I became so interested in space and physics, but I did. Mm-hmm. And it's been a great love affair through my life. And, it's kind of bedtime reading for me to be reading about quantum physics. In fact, I on my holidays recently, I was reading the Carlo Rovelli new book about time on my holidays on the beach. And, all my family were getting a great laugh out of, the complexity of our understanding of time being suitable reading for a beach doesn't seem to work for everybody, but it does for me. So I don't really know where the love of her came from, but always physics, always just how those things work, and deep space and the reality of space and the cosmos and how it all began and how it'll all end and, lying there at night dreaming about an ever-expanding universe and, sentences like, at some distant point in the future, every atom in existence will be infinitely separated from every other atom currently in existence, you know, and that could keep me, that can keep me awake for like 3 weeks, you know, so.
I was going to say, like, in terms of being able to sleep at night, I was like, I know I love reading this stuff too, but I can't read stuff that's going to bend my, and break my brain before bed. And it's amazing that you're able to digest that, you know, while you're at least trying to wind down from the day.
No, I'm not able to. I mean, you know, that's basically the problem. I seem to, you know, I've got some sort of fatal flaw that compels me to keep reading, even though it will keep me awake. I wait till 5 in the morning.
And who were some of the science writers that were keeping you up at night that kind of just fed your scientific, you know, rigor and obsession?
I can't recall. I can't recall that. I've probably, you know, painted it as though I was reading amazingly interesting physics textbooks, but I was more probably reading Larry Niven and Alfred Bester and Isaac Asimov. You know, you're probably finding, you know, I have rewritten the narrative to include some seriously interesting books, whereas in fact it was probably sci-fi trash mostly that was doing it.
Were you reading any Carl Sagan?
Sorry. I don't mean to call it sci-fi trash. That was the wrong trashy type of sci-fi novel, but I would read anything in sci-fi. So I'm undiscerning.
Right, right. Were you reading any Carl Sagan at all or Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Not Neil deGrasse, but certainly Carl Sagan. You know, a huge fan of his writing, huge fan of his TV work. And you know, he'd be, I would be a big fan of his way of looking at the world, and in fact, you know, very openly understand it to be the scene setter for how the story of my film The Farthest came about in terms of how it told the story, you know, because Carl Sagan was the first person who, you know, had the bravery and the vision and the madness and the poetry just, you know, to unite these big ideas, that it wasn't just bald facts, you know, that it was to do with spirituality or to do with ache, you know. He was really talking about science and physics and the cosmos, really in the space between science and art, you know, and he was happily doing that, and he brought so many people along with his way of looking at existence, you know, and I would have definitely been a huge fan of that.
Yeah, there's a point in The Farthest towards the end when they decided to turn Voyager. Would have been Voyager. Voyager 1. They turned Voyager 1 around to take the quote unquote family photo of the galaxy, and mm-hmm. you know, and the little pinprick of Earth and that sunbeam, and then the way that. Is the one person you interviewed and said, I even pulled this out. He said, like, in the hands of Carl, he turned it into an allegory on the human condition. And it was truly like a beautiful sentiment that he was able to share, that that little pinprick of light is where everyone we've ever known and ever will know lived out their lives and everything. It was just really a beautiful sentiment that you're really alluding to by just the way you talk about him.
Well, you know, and he, now it seems like normal to us that, you know, he would speak about it that way, and that we would reflect on the universe and the cosmos in that way. But in the 70s and 80s, you know, when he was starting to speak like that, there was kickback. You know, the scientific community didn't like that kind of popularizing of science, or let's say the spiritualizing of science, you know. And but you know, he persisted, and look what he did, you know. A kind of a universe he kicked off in terms of our understanding of our insignificance, but also our significance, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he, of course, you know, he inspires people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and then, and so many others, where it's almost, the more popular scientists, it goes without saying that they're going to know the scientific, the mathematics behind the universe, which to even a math nerd will look kind of like hieroglyphics. But then it's it's kind of like an accepted thing now that you're going to have someone who can like pull it in and not dumb it down, but put it in terms so we can all kind of get our head around it. It really all kind of started with him, right?
It really, really did. And he was on the Voyager imaging team. He was an active member of that team while he was beginning. That was really at the beginning of his journey into TV and being the science communicator that he became, this world beater science communicator that he became, so it's a really interesting start to the story that it wasn't necessarily that pop, not it was frowned upon in some ways at that time, but he led the way, and I benefited, we benefited in making the film because all the scientists and engineers from Voyager that spoke to us so beautifully in the film, they were really on board with the idea of communication. They were really on board with the idea of telling this story to a broad audience. That it isn't a conversation to do with dumbing it down. It's a conversation to do with expressing it. Pull me into the joy of discovery, the joy of scientific method. Really give me an insight into what that was like to be there. And they were from the start. I think in America you call it outreach, which I had never heard that word before. But that idea of that actually. It's incumbent upon these scientists and creatives and artists and and engineers to reach out to the public, to children, and express it and pull everyone into the vision.
In your experience with interviewing, countless scientists, who are some of those, or who has inspired you in the way that they're able to, communicate this wonderful material so in such a way that you're able to shape it and tell a wonderful story.
Well, all of the people, Claire Strong, one of my two producers, along with John Murray, and Claire and I went on a very deep research trip to meet, as many of the scientists and engineers that were involved with Voyager as we could, and to try to get to know them and bring them on board with this idea of, communicating to a wide audience, not just space geeks, that we would communicate to everybody. And we ended up kind of like whittling it down into a cast of characters that would communicate. And I think they're all spectacular at it. But it's actually funny because Claire often tells the story that before we, when we were setting up the film and we were starting our research process, that I was asking the researchers to look for, that we would need to talk to philosophers and writers and poets, as well as the scientists and engineers, so that we could talk to those people about, the philosophical questions, the primal questions that this film was going to hopefully kick off. So we started off looking for, I'd say philosophers and poets who could talk to this idea. And then almost as soon as we, started meeting the engineers and the scientists who were, intrinsic and central to the actual story, the actual people who built it and flew this spacecraft, we realized we did not need these other kind of third-party voices commenting on the beauty of space or the reality of existence or existential questions, that these scientists and engineers were quite happy, to go down that road with us, and when you see the film, they talk about it's a story about longing, and they quite happily express the big cosmic questions. So, I'm dazzled by them all. I have every few weeks I get I have a different favorite from the film, but when I watch it, I saw it again last week at this beautiful festival here in Dublin called the Festival of Curiosity.
Oh,
So
wow.
you should come over and interview people from that next year. But they showed it last week, and I watch it and I'm like, all these extraordinary people who did this extraordinary thing, and they're not only amazing people who can actually pull this off, but they want to share their spirit. They want to share their spirit as creatives with the audience with such honesty, such humanity. I'm dazzled by them all.
And telling these kinds of stories, it's never enough that you want to tell a cool story. You have to get the people on board to help convey it. And like you were saying, yeah, essentially you and your producers kind of lobby some of these people to come on film and to talk so candidly and beautifully about it. So what was that process like of courting the scientists and the engineers, and then getting them to feel comfortable and to talk about their mission and their work?
As I said, we went off and did a kind of a 2 week, 14 cities in 10 days or something like that kind of a process where breakfast, lunch and dinner, we met the same people that were central to the stories. That was really born out of an instinct that we would get an opportunity to really express to them the sort of film we wanted to make, that it wasn't, we weren't looking for, a 40-year anniversary film about Voyager that would just be the facts, come in and tell me what you discover on that moon or what did you learn at that flyby. That we actually were interested in the human heart of it, and so getting to meet them and getting to pitch that idea that we wanted to make an expansive, beautiful, epic cinematic film. I mean, this story, the story of Voyager. There's been fine TV documentaries made about it over the years, many fine films, but it had never been given, the big screen treatment. It had never been given the big epic cinematic adventure treatment, which the story really deserved. So the process really was meeting them, getting to know them on the phone. Initially, Claire had many long conversations with them about trying to tell them what we were doing. Then we went to meet them all and really just kind of, got them excited about what we were trying to do, and they all bought into it as an idea, and we're so generous. We're so generous with their time and with their stories and with their ability or with their instinct to trust us and be part of that type of storytelling.
Well, the movie, what's so great about it was the mission itself structurally lent itself to have these moments of exposition that where you can talk about the moons of Uranus and Saturn, Jupiter, and you can get granular on the science and the facts and the atmospheric science and if this, that, and the other. But then in the long beats between when Voyager is on its way from Jupiter to Saturn, then you're filling in some of those more cinematic and artful things. So as you were structuring this movie, like, did it really feel like, oh, these are our times to be more artful, and these are our times to get really expositional?
We often used to say at the very start, that Voyager was just this, it was a perfect spacecraft to which we could make this film, because it has the golden record, which is, an attempt to talk to aliens. It is going to outlive humanity and circle the galaxy long after we're gone. And it had this extraordinary, early life of knocking it out of the park in terms of science, So so it had all these pieces to its story. It wasn't a metaphor, it wasn't a kind of an imaginary spacecraft. It was a real spacecraft that actually has all these kind of attributes. So very, very early on, it was conceived that this spacecraft and this film could be told basically in kind of three intertwined stories, one being the spacecraft and the actual hard science of get to the planets, find out all this amazing shit, look at these amazing images that we'd never seen before, and all the scientists dazzled by their findings and it happening over years and years and years. And then it knocks it out of the park, gets to interstellar space, the first time we've ever done that. So it really was an amazing being, having this amazing scientific adventure story. And all of that was always going to be, as you say, granular, interesting science. And then it has the golden record, which is weaving around this core story, which is just this mind-expanding adventure about how would we communicate to aliens? What would we say about ourselves? What matters to us? Why does it matter to us to communicate? And is there anybody out there at all? And what would they know about us? What would we wish them to know about us? And also, is it, given that there's probably no aliens that will ever find this craft, we're really just talking to ourselves, you know. So that was a second strand that was weaving around the hard science strand, which was a philosophical, you know, creative, artistic, music, all those ideas strand. And then it absolutely lent itself to this third layer, which I was always not most interested in, but very, very, very keen to have in the film, because I think the secret about why The Farthest hopefully works and touches people is because it really reflects that feeling that I think space kind of kicks off in us all. You know, we look up at night and we wonder, and we have those feelings of, you know, our consciousness expands for a moment. We feel these feelings to do with what's it all for. You know, when we look up at the moon or we look up at the stars on a dark night in our backyard, and, you know, we get these frissons of knowing, you know, of self-knowing or of curiosity and profound kind of spiritual, you know, not in a religious way, in this moment of, you know, cosmic questioning of our own existence. And so the film also then had that third strand, which would allow us to kind of, and the story of Voyager and the Golden Record allowed us to wander into those places, because it is going to outlive humanity long after we're gone. You're able to talk about, you know, why does that matter to us? Is it like a gravestone? Is it a marker? Why does it matter that we, you know, these very, very philosophical ideas about why legacy matters? You know, why does it matter when we're gone that somebody, anybody ever knew that we were here? And when you're talking about space and time and distance, that how far Voyager is going, will it ever be found? You're able to consider those big picture ideas to do with the size of the universe, the beginning of time, the end of time, you know. So, yeah, not a metaphor, a real spacecraft that did this, a real little being that did this. And yeah, always conceived from the start as being, you know, a vehicle, you know, literally a vehicle that would allow me and the team to wander down all those little back roads too. And of course, you know, it was written like that and it was structured like that. But of course, you get to the edit and then things change as well, you know. And the amount of science we could take, you know, at each planet became complex because, you know, the film is 2 hours long, and, you know, it could have been 6 hours long or longer. You know, there was some amazing science that I would have loved to have included that really just, you know, the film couldn't tolerate in terms of, you know, time and storytelling.
Yeah, that's one of the questions I had with respect to this too, is how the project changed as you were in post production and editing, and maybe like what were those decisions like when you had to cut something that you really liked, but it's just like, you know, I love this, but it's got to go because it's not in the service of time, and ultimately it might be a little repetitive, or in the service of it doesn't move the story quite as forward as this other anecdote. Like, what's that process like for you?
It was excruciating, if truth were told. There was a fantastic sequence. I know you love Cassini, so you know Linda Spilker, who's the project scientist on Cassini. She was a junior member of the Voyager imaging, the Voyager team, and she talks about, she had a beautiful sequence about that she used to go into a corridor and roll out this kind of like printout that she would have gotten, you know, this long roll of information that was on Saturn's rings. And she talked about that she would wander, you know, alone along this corridor looking at this graph paper with all this information with the rings, and imagined herself actually walking on Saturn's rings. And we had this most beautiful sequence about, you know, a young woman in LA imagining herself, you know, on Saturn's rings and learning all this science. And it was really, really stunning. And yet, you know, hit the editing floor tragically because of, you know, we were by then an hour in, and we knew we still had two more planets to get to, and we had interstellar space to get to, and, you know, a real feeling of, a really tough feeling of leaving stuff out because they didn't, even though they were magnificent, they couldn't, the film couldn't take the intensity of all that detail at certain points. You understand that your audience have a desire to keep moving, and as you say, repetition. You want to keep. We needed each planet to have almost to have a different identity. So there were various restrictions like that, and various brilliant scenes that hit the ground. In fact, often when I look at the film, I think of, now when I look at it, I think, if it was a narrative film, you would have finished it at the pale blue dot with Carl Sagan talking about, we look back at this speck of humanity and we reflect on everyone we ever loved and everyone we ever knew. It's a beautiful moment where you realize, what did Nick call it? This mote of dust floating in a cosmic night. And narrative, if it was a narrative feature, you'd have finished the film there, But in the documentary, we were doing the 40-year story. It still had to, Voyager still went on and reaches interstellar space. And, so there was a whole other chapter still to go after that, So all of those, they were tough. I had a brilliant editor and a brilliant team who would allow me to spend a day crying over a scene and then pick myself up and agree to it being cut.
And I suspect that throughout the process of putting in packaging the movie, that you could have chosen any kind of music you wanted, and ethereal music that seems to play well with space. But a lot of the what you chose was, and I love this because I'm a rock and heavy metal guy. Not that you use heavy metal, but I love rock and
Good, good,
roll.
good. Yeah.
And you guys went with a lot of classic rock, some harder rock. And I love, what was the decision to use a lot of that kind of music to make all of Voyager like a rock star in this film?
Look, the music in the film has kind of, I must be some way obsessed with trees at the moment, but it had kind of like the score written by our composer, which was, we chose not to go for that kind of Pink Floyd dreamy spacey feel. For some reason, I can't really remember the conversations, but I know that we wanted to do something maybe more acoustic, more human, more delicate, more modern than that. So he was off on one track doing the score. Then we had all the little beats that came out of the Golden Record and little snatches of Louis Armstrong and Bach and Peruvian pan pipes. So they were all going to get peppered through the film. And then the third element, as you're talking about, is the kind of the commercial tracks. And so I started from the idea that Voyager left in 1977, so that Voyager itself had never updated her record collection. She was out there dreaming of an Earth pre-1977. So we decided to only use tracks pre-1977, with one exception, which is the final song in the film is a song called The Race by Archer Pruitt, and that's 2002, I think. And that was the only exception we made, and that was because it was part of the inception for the decision to make the film. I had heard it when I was driving, years and years ago. I heard it and I was thinking, it's such a beautiful song about, the lyrics go, we've won the race, we've claimed our place forever cold and lost in space, And I remember hearing it on the radio and thinking, if I ever make that film about, if we ever get to make that film about Voyager, I'm going to use this song. So that was the only notable exception. All the other tracks, from Pink Floyd to the Carpenters to Gallagher and Lyle, they were all pre-1977. And in fact, I'm not sure they were, no, they definitely weren't chosen to give it a more rocky feel. They were all chosen to push forward the narrative. So at every point, they're used like, Breakaway, the Gallagher and Lyle track that's used when Voyager is launched. That was a fun, we were looking for songs from the 70s, pre-1977, who would give you that feeling of this little being that you've created. You're now sending it off out into outer space. You'll never see it again. So we were looking for the feeling that would give you that, ache of the emotional jolt of it gone. And you know, the carpenters, when he used calling occupants, that was to, you know, that was to kick off a section to do with, are aliens out there? Could we ever meet them? How would we communicate? You know, so they were all really chosen for probably emotional truth and a little bit of a narrative bounce.
So when did the kernel of the idea of a documentary on the Voyager mission, when did that kind of just stick in your brain and you're like, this is something I'd like to do someday? And then when the idea, when you had the opportunity, you were able to sort of fall on the on that ball.
John Murray, who, as I said, co-produced Here Was Cuba, co-directed Here Was Cuba with me, when we had finished making that film, we were sitting down to try to imagine what film we'd make next. And space was an absolute natural fit for both of us mad space nuts, and both of us kind of discovered in each other a bit of an obsession with Voyager. So we kind of talked about Voyager, you know, as I said, this classic, you know, not a metaphor film that allows you to do art and science and, you know, all these big ideas. And as we were discussing it, literally the very weekend, we were like, hey, what about Voyager? Voyager would be an amazing film. And it had never been done before. Literally that very weekend, NASA announced that Voyager 1 had broken free of the solar system and entered interstellar space, you know. So it was like a really brilliant moment of serendipity. We were like, this film now can be made. You know, it's, Voyager is back in the news. You know, it's back relevant. You know, it's not this dusty old spacecraft off there, gone out there since, you know, since the 70s. It's actually doing something humans have never done before right today. So that was the spur. That was the moment. It was, we thought, you know, so we went out to, you know, funders and interested parties immediately with, you know, making it through the prism of it having reached interstellar space. And everybody was delighted and very interested straight away. Yeah. So that was how it became an idea and into a film, luckily.
Yeah. And because Voyager became, yeah, I believe it was about 2012. Was that when it entered interstellar space?
Yeah, it entered in interstellar space in 2012, but it wasn't announced until 2013. They took them a whole year to kind of validate the information and to feel confident that they could announce that it had actually reached interstellar space.
So
our journey started in 2013.
All right. So with that knowledge, then of course, then Voyager kind of comes back to the top of the story pile for probably a lot of people across the world. Did you feel any pressure to like, well, we're probably not the only ones thinking about making a movie about this or a book or anything. So were you, was there a feeling of urgency that you're like, all right, this is our time. Let's, we got to do this now and pronto.
I don't remember. Maybe I was very innocent then and I'm less innocent now. So, for example, recently, over the last year or two, we've been looking at making a film of Mars. And it's like, oh, get to the end of the queue. Everyone's making a film about Mars or making a film about the moon landings next year. It's the same thing. So I've become more aware about that idea now, you know, that feeling now that you've probably, you know, everybody has probably had the thought at the same time. I was possibly more innocent then, and I had no sense that we were, you know, competing with other people. I just thought, this is a great idea. We should do this. And we went out and, you know, started looking for partners to do it with.
Yeah, no, that's great that the timing couldn't have worked out any better. And in the making of this film or any, you know, or Here Was Cuba or that nature, what is your favorite aspect or of the process, or where do you feel most alive and engaged in the process of, you know, making a film?
I told you I started life as an editor, so I certainly love the editing process. I didn't cut the farthest myself. Fantastic BAFTA and ACE winning editor Tony Cranston cut it, and I really, really enjoyed that process, you know, because you're definitely redrafting the story, you know, really finding the film in the edit in a documentary. But No, but and but slash and possibly because, I've been locked away in dark rooms for 20 years and now I've been liberated. I'm out on the floor, I'm out shooting, I'm out meeting people and all that. The shoot, the visual shoot and the meeting, the interviewees, meeting all the amazing characters, both on Here Was Cuba and on the Farthest, was my favorite part. Don't tell the editor I said that, but I absolutely loved, in some ways, throwing off the editor in me and saying, we'll figure that out later. For now, I'm just going to just dive in and explore this world and see what comes out of this process, and I'm about to, in fact, I'm starting pre-production on my new documentary next week, and we're not shooting now till October, November, but I have a real excitement about doing the research, finding out where to go, how to shoot it, how I might tell it, and then like literally can't wait for the shoot. I mean, it's insane. It's long, long days and long, long nights preparing for the next day and the next interview, but it's so exciting and it's so empowering and what is the word? It just fills you with so much energy, learning new stuff.
Right. And you kind of alluding to it there with thinking as you're starting a new film. I always love talking about daily rituals for an artist. How we go about setting up our day so we feel like it's going to be accomplished, and then even towards the end of the day where you're sort of setting up the next day. I call like setting up the bowling pins so the next day you can start knocking them down. And so as you're kind of with respect to the movies you've made and also the movies going forward, how do you set up your days from when you wake up until the end of the day, so you can feel like you've attacked that particular day with a certain sense of accomplishment?
It's kind of different in all the phases. The first phase being kind of pre-production and research, and then second phase being shoot, and the third phase being the edit and that end of things. I probably approach all three very differently, or maybe not so differently. But I have when I'm in pre-production, I get up very early, I work very late at night, and I do a huge amount of, maybe it is bowling pin setting uppage. I do an awful lot of lists, I do an awful lot of, trying to deconstruct all the ideas, the visual ideas, the story ideas, all the people that I want to talk to, so there's endless refining. And it's an awful lot of desk work, it's an awful lot of reading and writing, it's an awful lot of going out and taking millions of photos, so there's a real almost like gathering the information, like sucking in loads and loads of stuff. So it's a very, very intense phase. Then when I get to shooting, even though I'm working very, very hard and it's very, very focused, it feels much more like my open, that you open the doors of your mind and of your process to stay alert and to stay alive for all the potential. And some of the days on The Farthest, I felt like I was running a marathon, like you're absolutely on duty when you're turned on in every way, all your senses, all your emotions, all your eyes, your nose, everything is like your nerve endings are very, very alert all the time. And then I got to the edit, and perhaps because I had such a wonderful editor, or perhaps because I'd been an editor before, it felt like a much more organic and settled place where story was really rising to the top at a very coherent and solid rate. It didn't have the nerve ending jangling feeling of the shoot. It had a very, very powerful, really, really working the material at a very in a dignified way, very, very structured way. So I don't know if I've answered your question there particularly, but you know, I don't know what routines I have apart from they seem to have all three phases seem to have a different identity for me.
Let's see, how being primarily being an editor at first, how are you able to learn to divorce your editor brain from your the generative phase to, you know what, let's shoot everything and then worry about editing later. Sometimes there's a gap there where the editor brain gets in the way of the information gathering. So how have you learned to divorce those two?
I tried really, really. I mean, I made it a kind of. I actually had a sticker up over my desk, you know, and it was basically that idea that I'm going to trust my instincts on the shoot. I'm going to shoot what I feel like, even if the editor brain inside my head is going, "We'll never use that. There's no role for that. How will that fit in?" You know, I was really silencing that part of my mind when I was shooting because I wanted to get the benefit of being free and knowing that, you know, at some other point later, somebody else in collaboration with me will either figure it out or find a way to use it. And that actually the madness and the instinct and the stuff that you can't prepare for or you don't know how it'll work is somewhere where all the magic comes. So I was really, really consciously turning those dials off. But I was also keeping some of them on because my editor brain was really helping me in terms of you know, the storytelling and how to stay on track in terms of, you know, what story beats I need, what story ideas I needed to try to find visual language for or find a way to communicate. So it was a little bit schizophrenic and kind of continues to be. You know, I have a desire to throw it off and yet keep it closed all at the same time. So yeah, I've actually edited, you know, I haven't edited now for over a year. And so it's slightly easier on my new film going forward. You know, I kind of feel I'm a little bit less, you know, less aware of that part of my brain now, but I'm sure she'll come back out to give out to me for shooting stuff that I won't need.
And you used a great term of deconstructing your days a little while ago, and using parlaying that term forward. What are some documentaries that you've watched, or even feature films that help inform your documentaries that you've watched over and over again, and you do try to work backwards and deconstruct how the filmmaker made it, so then it can help you tell the stories you want to tell. If there are any that come to mind, that'd be great to hear your insights on those.
You know, probably like I watched a film last night, for example, for the and not a significant film, a feature, a Norwegian drama, but I watched it for the second time because I had watched it the night before, and then my husband wanted to watch it with me again. I wanted to watch it, so I watched it again, and it was an example of me, yeah, in deconstruction mode. You know, I just watched it from the point of view of a filmmaker. You know, the visual style, the structure, you know, all the beats, how to use the music, you know. So, but like, of course, like all humans, you know, if I'm enthralled by a film, a documentary or a narrative film, if I'm actually sucked in by it, I don't see anything. I don't see the editing, the music, the performances. I just see, you know, what's really happening. So I do watch some films a few times. So for example, I've watched, I don't know if you've seen the documentary, the Fire at Sea, from last year, the year or two ago. I think it's like it's perfection in every way. And you know, I would watch something like that, even though it possibly hasn't a lot to say to me about the style of film I make, or I'm certainly the next one I'm making. But material like that, or you know, a film like The Possibilities Are Endless, which is a beautiful documentary, Scottish documentary. About a singer who had a brain aneurysm, you know, and his kind of fragmentary memories. I love Errol Morris. I'd watch Errol Morris all day and all night. You know, so you're looking for other artists who may even not be in the same wheelhouse as you, but who are teaching you something about how you might put two or four ideas of your own that are fragments together, you know. So Yeah, just look, it's all brain food. It's all creative food. It's all a way of trying to articulate and deconstruct instincts that are kind of writhing around, trying to find form, and trying to find an outlet for them. I watched Waltz with Bashir there a few weeks ago, and it's a kind of a, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's like a documentary crossed with an animated film, so there's so many films and so many documentaries, so many artists who are pushing boundaries, and even if they're not literally talking to you at where you are, you're going to learn stuff, and as I said, it'll find something in your own mind that's bubbling or trying to find form will find expression.
In terms of your filmmaking, is there anything that you wish you knew 20 that you know now that you wish you knew 15, 20 years ago?
I don't know if there is. I don't know if I want to know stuff that, I think it's okay to make mistakes. I think it's okay to realize later what you should have done before. I certainly couldn't have made the farthest 20 years ago. I wouldn't have had the emotional maturity, to understand how to communicate, how an audience want to communicate, what want you to communicate with them, want to be allowed in. So no, I'm not sure there is anything that I wish I knew then. I'm quite happy to keep blundering on.
Emotional maturity is something that takes a lot of patience, and it's something I think a lot of any artist and anything, it sometimes cultivating that sense of patience is hard because you want the your work to be recognized. You don't want to wallow in obscurity, and sometimes in that time that you are kind of obscure and wallowing and making work that doesn't seem to be getting sticky. It can be very easy to maybe get jealous or feel competitive with peers, and you wonder why maybe someone who's like 10 years younger than you, they seem to be on a track that's going far ahead of you, and you're like, why? What am I doing wrong? I'm a hard worker. I have talent, but it's not sticking. And I wonder, maybe with your work, do you have any instances of dealing with jealousy and the competitive feelings, and how did you maybe endure those feelings?
It's a very, very interesting question because, by its nature, when you make a film, it's competing, with other films, for the audience's attention, for the critics' attention, for the festival slots, and that's a really, unhappy or unfortunate part of it. I was certainly, when we were, getting the farthest out there was a feeling of, why didn't we get selected for that festival, and why did this other film get there? And but in a very short while, I very quickly into that feeling, because I thought, what this film, this journey, this instinct to create something and communicate, shouldn't be poisoned by those ideas. It's a terrible shame if it is. So very, very quickly, I think we found this place where we were like, look, we've made a film that we love, and it's about the process, and it's about the work, and it's about making something you feel happy with. And I moved very quickly because I was quite new to it last year with the farthest, that feeling of, oh wow, you are actually out there in the world with other films. And I think that feeling of fear or jealousy or competitiveness, I didn't like it at all, and I didn't like it even surfacing, and I wasn't really prepared for it. And when it did, I kind of moved very quickly to either shut it down or just accommodate it, in the sense of, okay, if this is what the industry needs, if this is normal part of this, I need to just accept that and move into the place where I want to be, which is, did we make a film that we can stand over, that we love, that we want to show? Did the process suit me? Did it work? Did I learn stuff? Did my colleagues and my team learn stuff? Will we, if all else failed and it was only ever shown to our families, would we still feel proud of the work and proud of the process? And when the answers were yes, a resounding yes to all of those, I made a very concerted effort, and I think I was, I think I hope I was successful at it, just to feel, to focus on the work and let the business side of it, all the distributors, all the festivals, all that stuff, just, fade away into some other place, because it's nothing to do with the work. It's nothing to do with the artistic instinct, the creative instinct, the documentarian's instinct to tell a story and reach people. It's all separate to us. So, yeah, I had a small bump off it, and I didn't like it at all, and I just thought it was really, really unhelpful and toxic. Toxic to the work,
Right.
and have made a concerted effort to turn it all back, turn it all off. And really, if that means you have to not read reviews or not go on Twitter, I think that's what you have to do. You have to protect yourself and the peace. And John Murray, who was my co-director on Here Was Cuba, became my producer on The Furthest. He always says, look, if you drop the DCP down a manhole or into the sea, on your way to the premiere, you have to feel that the work had value. It had value outside of what other people say about it, whatever, what the experience of showing it is, and I think he's right. Although I think if it went down a manhole, I would jump down after it. That being said, this, I think he's right. The feeling is, the work itself, because we spend such of our t so much of our lives, so much time, so much emotional and creative energy making these films, making these works of art, these expressive pieces, trying to talk to something. Really, we just have to protect that above all else.
And maybe in the spirit of Carl Sagan, like when you through the production and the packaging and the making of Voyager and your own personal study of the cosmos and learning about how simultaneously significant and insignificant we are, I wonder, like, how is your Yeah, what have been your takeaways, like when you turn your eyes to the sky, and maybe your approach to fear and insecurity when you realize, after what you've been able to do and you see the scope of the universe. I wonder, like, what your big takeaway and what you've learned in the process of sort of studying the universe.
I think you're right. I think, that recognition through the film and through Carl Sagan and through Voyager its very self had actually, it probably got into me on a very cellular level, that idea of, we are all so insignificant, and yet, not to each other, in our own lives, we're, and the film was a really, a very serious and honest and emotional attempt to travel between those binaries, these huge ideas of we're nothing, we're just this little dot in this back end of this one universe, possibly among billions of universes, and yet here and now to each other and in real life, we really matter, and our relationships really matter, and that we do right really matters, and that we tell the truth really matters. And, so it definitely has gotten into my cells and maybe has helped me with those ideas of fear and what does it matter if the film gets a bad review or somebody doesn't like it? I haven't been wounded or crushed. I'm genuinely extremely interested in how people respond to the film on all levels, like it or hate it, or and so it has been a really interesting kind of, emotional journey, making it and seeing people responding to it. And I've had the last year of showing it, I've had some extraordinarily profound moments. A woman came up to me in New York and said that the film, first time since the presidential election that she felt hope, and stuff like that will really, that's the stuff that I'm taking at night rather than the, you know, what festival it didn't get into. You know, that's the stuff that I keep coming back to, that we talked to people where they live, you know, about hope, about meaning, you know, and we got an opportunity to, you know, to celebrate science, to celebrate existence, to celebrate all these big ideas. And the film, somebody said to me at one festival, you know, that the film was kind of half about the desire to know, you know, that we were sending Voyager out there to discover things, but it was half about the desire to be known. And you know, and I think that's true. I think that's true possibly about our lives as well, isn't it? This idea that we, you know, we want to do stuff, but we also, we're these huge, big bags of water having, you know, emotional journeys and philosophical journeys through our lives. And yeah, the film and the whole experience of making it has taught me a lot about, you know, it's much more than a film about space. You know, it's a film about being human, about, you know, the mysteries that define our lives.
Well, Emer, with respect to your time, of course, this has been a lovely conversation, getting to know you a little bit more and your approach to the work and, of course, your wonderful film. Where can people maybe get more familiar with you and your work, find you online, and where can people find the movie if they haven't seen it already?
Well, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, The Farthest Film, and myself personally, so they can track us down there. The film can be downloaded and bought, I believe, on Amazon. On Netflix, there is a version of it, a TV version of the film. And keep an eye out for it in, it's frequently popping up in all sorts of curious little festivals still, you know, it's still traveling the world. Year and a half after its launch, so yeah, track it down.
Very Voyager-like that it's still just kind of out there traveling,
wandering on. And my next film, I can't really say what it's about, Brendan, but it's a film about a rock star. So you might well talk to me about that one if you're a rock interest.
Oh yes, please and thank you. We'll you'll have to come back on for a second trip. It'll be your Voyager 2 trip to the podcast.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for the time. This was, like I said, great getting to talk to you and get to know you and your approach to the work. So we will certainly be in touch down the road, Emer. Thanks again, and we'll be talking.
Thanks so much, Brendan. Lovely to talk to you.
You too. Take care. Well, that was nice, wasn't it? Thanks again to Hippocamp for the support. You only have this week to use that CNF Pod promo code to get $50 off your registration fee. Be sure to head over to BrendanO'Mara.com to sign up for the monthly email newsletter. Once a month, no spam. Can't beat it. I think that's it, CNFers. Thanks for listening. Listening? Thanks for listening? No. Thanks for listening. Let the rock and roll just take you away. I'm gonna go for a walk and think about some things. See ya!